science and Grandpa Pumpkin. Neighbor science is cool and Grandpa Pumpkin rule. Neighbor science and Grandpa Pumpkin are our only hope.
Yeah, so the brief explanation of it is this election was not even like a regular election. It was an early election. So Theresa May and the Conservatives had a majority. They were, you know, already governing the UK. And so they called an early election because they arrogantly believed that they would get an even bigger majority. So
and that backfired.
Right. So instead, they fucking ate shit. And based Jezza is now, he caused a hung parliament, which means that there's actually no ruling party. So there's going to have to be a coalition government. And so the other thing is, it was actually kind of a lot like the American election, you know, the Trump election, in that all of these voting districts that were normally conservative voted Labour and vice versa. So like Scotland flipped from being Labour to being conservative, and then like the south of England flipped from being conservative to being Labour.
What?
Yeah, yeah. And another similarity is that, you know, 1 month ago the projection was that it was so clear that the conservatives would wipe the floor that like nobody thought that Corbyn had a shot in hell. And so in 1 month it completely flipped. And that's the reason that they called the election early, is because they're like, oh, we have one of the biggest majorities in British election history, so like we should call this election early and then gain seats so that we have an even stronger rule in the government.
My God, this, I'm not going to lie, this whole thing is a little bit shocking.
Yeah,
I had no idea it was. Yeah, it's. Look at our wonderful representative democracy and how well it functions.
And so, yeah, I watched a couple videos about it. One was from H Bomber Guy, who's great. He's like a British like gamer dude. And then there was also a Chapo Trap House special episode about it. And they brought up the point that the last election, where Labour lost pretty considerably, they were running Ed Miliband, and he was kind of the the left equivalent of the Cuckservative. He was he was kind of just like the neoliberal centrist milquetoast little bitch, and he did really poorly. And Corbyn is like running on a platform of sensible, you know, leftist reform, actually trying to, you know, appeal to people's interests. He wanted to get rid of college debt, he wanted to improve the NHS, all these other reforms, and he campaigned on that, and he was doing like a lot of campaigning. And so, you know, Chapo pointed out, this is exactly like the kind of Bernie Sanders-ish platform, what we've been saying the whole time, which is that, you know, if you want a leftist candidate to win, you can't be this compromising little shit. You have to actually like have a platform that makes sense for people, that actually appeals to people, makes them want to vote for you.
Exactly.
So I think he proved that pretty considerably, pretty conclusively, I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. If only the Democratic Party had gone with Bernie.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, because he definitely would have won the general election.
Okay, so I found some of the responses from world leaders and influential people around the world to this UK election to be quite hilarious. I think my favorite so far is I think it was Guy Verhofstadt, who is one of the major Brexit negotiators.
I was hoping you were going to say Guy Fieri.
I think it was him that said another own goal, which is absolutely genius. I think he said yet another own goal after Cameron, now May, will make already complex negotiations even more complicated,
mm-hmm.
which is obviously really true. I know that Angela Merkel has refused to comment out of politeness and respect. While
so
the
she doesn't
want to
gloat?
Well, I'm not sure if it's that she doesn't want to gloat or she's just not very happy with the outcome.
Oh, okay.
And by saying anything, she's going to let something slip that she wouldn't otherwise do. I know Carl Bildt, the Swedish Prime Minister, has called the entire outcome very messy. Let me see if I can just quickly pull up his tweet. Oh, yeah. One mess risks following another. Price to be paid for lack of true leadership. Yeah. So I'm just finding it interesting that a lot of the international community has basically... They're almost laughing at the UK in much the same way as we were laughing at the US for voting Trump in. And I don't think that it's a laugh at Corbyn's successes. I think it's a laugh at the laughability of the UK political system in
right.
general. And in all honesty, I feel like it's a huge indictment of representative democracy and its many, many failings.
Yeah, so yeah, if anyone wants to know more, and you know, I highly recommend both of those sources, H-Bomber Guy on YouTube and Chapo Trap House, the podcast. They're pretty great.
So after having done a little bit of search, obviously I live here in the Middle East, in the Kingdom of Bahrain, and the big news that we've had in the last week here is that there's been a big diplomatic crisis involving Qatar, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Mauritius, Libya. It's basically the entire GCC. Oh, sorry. It's not Mauritius, it's the Maldives. Yeah, so basically what's happened is that Qatar has been essentially cut off from the rest of the GCC. And incidentally, it happened right after Trump left Saudi Arabia. Now, I don't know exactly what went down there, and I'm not going to make any guesses and potentially have the NSA, thanks for listening, NSA, jump down my throat for saying anything. But immediately after Trump left Saudi Arabia and finished closing all the deals that they had going on there, pretty much the very next day, all this crap started happening with Qatar. Now, this is not to say that Qatar isn't a bit of a troublemaker here in the Middle East. They do have a history of hypocrisy in the area. You know, they spend a lot of time denouncing monarchies in Saudi, in Bahrain, when in the meantime their own democracy, and I use that with a heavy level of sarcasm, it's been passed down their presidency from father to son to father to son to father to son for decades. So between that and the fact that they do also have a history of protecting members of the Muslim Brotherhood, so including ISIS, including Al-Qaeda, they're basically big supporters of the terrorist unrest in the Middle East. So because of all of this, there has been a big fallout. Now, Saudi is busy saying that the reason for their actions now are because of Qatar's support of the Muslim Brotherhood, protecting members of the Muslim Brotherhood in Qatar, and essentially supporting terrorism. And Qatar is saying that all of this happened due to a misunderstanding because their state news agency got hacked into, and some statements regarding the Iranian royal family were made that were incorrect, that Qatar was supporting Iran, which they do actually do. at least on paper. But they're busy saying that all of this has been blown way out of proportion. The result of everything has been that Qatari diplomats were given 48 hours as of Monday, this previous Monday. They were given 48 hours to leave Saudi Arabia, to leave Bahrain, to leave the United Arab Emirates, Libya, Egypt, the Maldives, as well as any Saudi residents, all these GCC countries, all the residents that are living in Qatar have been asked to leave within 14 days, and vice versa for Qatari residents living in any of the GCC nations. Essentially, the land border and the ocean routes and the airline routes to and from Qatar have been shut down to the point where now Qatar's only logistical source is through Iran. Not all the GCC nations have shut off diplomatic relations. Kuwait and Oman are still busy chatting things out. But yeah, there's been a lot of tension here in the last week and a lot of news from our side.
So as someone who like definitely could never locate Qatar on a map and doesn't know like a ton about Middle East politics, doesn't Saudi Arabia also fund terrorism and harbor terrorists and shit? Like, what?
Well, when we take into consideration the fact that how many of the 9/11 attackers were shown to be Saudi, and
right.
There's, I mean, look, it's very complicated in this area. People take official positions while in the background doing something else entirely. There's hypocrisy from a lot of different angles. There's
so there could be like different factions that are, you know, saying
there are
this and,
so
okay.
Yeah, there are so many different factions that have different agendas that are not publicly aired, that are contrary to what they say in public, and it gets very complicated. I used to, before moving to the Middle East, I used to think, oh man, why can't we just sort this all out? It would be just so easy. And once you're in the thick of things, you start to realize, no, it's not going to be that easy. It's actually probably going to be a lot harder than anyone even realizes.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay,
so that's the situation in the Middle East at the moment. Expect your oil prices to fluctuate heavily in the coming months. Also, interesting to note that the GCC nations, as of this week, are finally introducing taxes. I know my cigarettes have just basically doubled in price as 100% sales tax has been added onto that.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. So we got our first review from someone named Dave Martell of Mad American Network, who listened to several minutes of our podcast out of spite.
Wow.
I told him I told him his website looks like shit because he linked some fucking horrible article in Bad Boy Jail, and I was on my phone and looked at it, and it was seriously like there was 5 ads that took up the entire page, and then you scrolled down before you even got to like the top banner of his site. And then the layout overall was just horrendous. So he was like, oh, well, what does your website look like then? So I linked him the Post Scarcity Magazine site, which has no
which
ads.
Which is crisp and clean and beautiful.
And responsive and, so here's his review. Not only does your website look like it's from 92, your podcast is the most low-energy, talentless piece of dog shit I've ever heard. Just quit. I'm not being edgy, I'm being honest. You literally suck. You have absolutely no vocal talent, and you're painful to listen to. No charisma, no character. You're fucking terrible. End quote.
Oh, come on, Dave. Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah, so this is absolutely not me softening the blow of any criticism someone might have of me or Peter or the show by like leading with some ridiculous criticism from a huge idiot. I would never do that. I'm great at taking criticism. And I just wanted to say thanks for the feedback, Dave. I listened to your podcast, and I love that you base your entire personality on impersonating Odorous Arungus. He's my favorite musical stage character. And it was really funny that whoever wrote the script for your show would have you say something and then contradict yourself like in the next sentence. So I'm thinking maybe I'll try imitating a stage personality and using like self-destructive Dadaist arguments to improve the energy and character of the show. So thanks for the feedback, Dave. We love you. You're our first and biggest fan.
I love it too. I finally gave a link of the podcast to my own family. Uh-huh. They're yet to listen to it.
Aw. Well, I haven't even told my family about it.
I'm like, oh, I can't wait to be able to say, look at these great people that have... And they're like, oh, yeah, I forgot. Sorry.
I've played it for Diane, and she's just like, oh, it's cute. I like it. I'm like, okay, yeah. But would you listen to it on your own? Probably not.
fair enough. At least she's honest. You know, just like Dave.
he's an absolutely fantastic writer too. Like he's got like all these articles on his site and, you know, on top of the podcast, you know, there's stuff like, liberated women are human garbage and good men need to boycott them.
Oh God, an MRA.
You want me to read a little excerpt from it? What do you think?
Please do. I think it's necessary that we illustrate capabilities of those people who are trying to critique us so eloquently.
I'll preface it by saying his writing style is basically like he writes exactly like someone would talk in a normal conversation, and from the looks of it, he like just writes a single draft and posts it immediately without reading over it or anything.
In that case, please don't correct your language just because that's the way you would do it. Please read it exactly as it is written.
Right.
Including grammatical and spelling errors, please.
I can also do the odorous voice if that would be beneficial.
I think it would.
Okay. Everything has market value. Soap, bananas, speedboats, chariots, domesticated saber-toothed tigers, ballistas, and even women have market value. Projected market value of something is governed by a few different variables. Time preference, scarcity, supply and demand. Aggregate demand and time preference are both subjective variables. Demand is how consumers desire said product. Men all desire women, so there is clearly a demand for them, except for gay men, but they don't get to be included in this metaphor. Go ahead and call the SPLC. It's my article. I can do what I want. I can even throw all the gays into a wood chipper in this scenario if I want. Not saying that's what I want to do, but if you keep pissing me off, I might just do it to spite you. Starts up wood chipper. See if I'm joking. This is Dave's house, not yours, pussy.
Wow.
I actually did unintentionally correct something that he wrote. Instead of saying except for gay men, he said except for gay man. So, sorry everyone, I fucked it up.
The reason I asked you to not correct anything is because this is something I found very often is that those who think that their opinion is worth a damn when that opinion generally espouses something unethical or immoral or just a really bad idea. Mm-hmm. I have found that they, in general, just have the worst grammar and spelling. Now, I'm not saying that there is causation or correlation here, but in my personal experience, stupidity is as stupidity does. And then, of course, what we're looking at there is some really strong cognitive dissonance, where basically someone like Dave would then be needing psychologically to avoid reading anything that they've written, because he knows deep down inside that he's a douchebag, and he doesn't want to confront that fact. He wants to carry on being a douchebag because other douchebags congratulate him for being a douchebag. So yeah, well done, Dave.
Yeah, this is great stuff. If you want to learn more about why women are human garbage and how they are similar to domesticated saber-toothed tigers and ballistas in that they have market value, go to madamericannetwork.com. Or if you don't want to kill yourself, just don't go there and don't ever read anything that he writes because it's all horrible.
My God. As pricing manager of Business Industries Incorporated, I need you to calculate the price of our widgets.
No problem, sir. I got the latest supply and demand report from the widget price database, and according to my calculations, it will be $14.54, or $14.53793 to be exact.
Excellent. Change the price of the widgets to that.
I did, sir, but since the price used to be $12.81, demand has changed.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well, that means the optimal price is now $11.29.
That doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Well, sir, since demand has increased since yesterday when the price was $12.81, we had to raise our price to maximize profit. The thing is, fewer people are willing to buy a widget when it costs $14.54, which means demand drops, and so does the price where we are able to maximize profit.
Uh-huh.
However, once the price was set to $11.29, people went crazy because it was so much cheaper, they wanted to snap up a good deal before it was too late. Because of the increase in demand, I recalculated, and the price changed to $18.13. Now, no one in their right mind would be buying a widget, so demand is minuscule.
Why can't we just price it at, like, $12.99?
Because then we wouldn't be maximizing profits. So, since demand was so minuscule, that means we have to lower the price of the good to attract customers to buy it. So I lowered the price to $14.54, but then...
How long is it going to be working on this one price? And how much profit would we lose if we just priced it at $12.99?
Well, I barely sleep because the prices are so sensitive. I won't be able to quit working and at it until it reaches equilibrium or we go out of business. And since at least 75% of businesses don't act this way, probably a marginal amount of profit.
Can you think of any reason I shouldn't just get rid of your position and do the easier thing, pricing the widget at $12.99 and just selling as many as we can?
My economics manual doesn't say anything about that, but it sounds irrational, sir.
The main segment of what we're going to be talking about is prices. So we're going to start with the boring conventional explanations, and then we'll get into the more unusual ideas. So basically everyone knows the gist of the conventional explanation, which is supply and demand. Price goes up when supply goes down, or demand goes up. I don't think it's necessary to explain this too much. I don't think anyone out there is like confused or ignorant about supply and demand. It's a pretty basic and fairly intuitive concept. What I think is interesting or unusual about the conventional explanation is, most people have seen the X-shaped graph, or the graph with the two descending, the descending and ascending curve. The graph, if you look at it closely, is actually like completely nonsensical. On the X-axis, you have Q, which is the quantity, and on the Y-axis, you have P, which is the price. And so anyone who's drawn a graph in a math class, anyone who completed sixth grade knows that the x-axis is the independent variable that you can vary, and the y-axis is the dependent variable, which changes depending on x. So the implication from the setup is that price is the dependent variable and quantity is the independent variable, but the actual curves that they draw on the graph are the opposite. The demand curve is quantity demanded at a given price, and the supply curve is quantity supplied at a given price. So price
so
is
basically,
the...
So basically it's exactly the opposite way around in reality to the way it's depicted on a simple mathematical graph.
Right. And so if they drew the graph correctly, then you would come to the realization that the reality of prices, the price is what's varied and the quantity demanded and supplied is what changes. And this is how real businesses work. They don't do what we were just doing in the skit, which is like find the demand and the supply and like do a calculation and figure out a price based on it. They set a price based on the cost of what they're selling, and then they just vary the amount they sell. Because especially in modern times, most goods are not scarce at all. Apple can produce as many iPhones as it needs to. Like, as long as it can sell more iPhones, it can keep producing more iPhones. So it's not as if they're scarce, like, in any meaningful sense. The price just determines how much of them they sell and how much money they make off of the sale.
Okay, but before you go on, I just want to very quickly, I know that it's not really got that much to do with our subject matter today, but I have found in discussions with people in the past that talking about the concept of scarcity can get a little bit ambiguous. Mm-hmm. A lot of people see abundance and scarcity as opposites, and they think of scarcity in real terms when economics is actually talking about the disparity between supply and demand. So if you've got a huge demand but not much supply, then you've got scarcity. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the item in question is rare or that there isn't much of it, but it could mean, for instance, that for gold in a specific region, there might be ample gold in the ground, but getting to it and mining it could be so expensive that to produce the amount that is being demanded would drive the price through the roof. So in that case, scarcity isn't referring to actual physical quantities, but rather to the difference between supply and demand.
Right. And I found that a lot, like what a lot of people also mean by scarcity, is there are unlimited possibilities of how to use resources, but only a limited amount of resources. But that doesn't mean that we have scarcity, because you could do an unlimited number of things with, you know, a set of materials. That's complete nonsense.
Yeah, it really is.
Because the things you could do make no fucking sense at all. Like, we could build a billion gold cars, but no one would do that because it would make no sense.
Exactly. But Mike, how do I calculate the opportunity cost for my gold if I'm able to make a gold car, but I could also, you know, make a billion electronic devices?
Yeah. I guess, yeah. Let's go back to supply and demand.
Supply and demand and how they affect prices.
Yeah. So Investopedia, which is like, you know, the big, it's like Wikipedia for jabroni science. Investopedia and many other sources will not just call supply and demand like a theory of price or a model of price, but like a scientific law. So if you Google supply and demand, the first result you will probably get is Investopedia, and it will call it the law of supply and demand. But it's not like the law of thermodynamics, where no one has ever recorded a violation of the second law of thermodynamics ever anywhere.
Which is why it's called a scientific law.
Right. It's violated constantly, all the time. There's actually, like, entire classes of goods that are defined by the fact that they violate the supply and demand, the so-called law of supply and demand. So there's Veblen goods, which is basically, like, conspicuous consumption goods. So the higher the price, the more rich people want to buy them to signal their high status. So something like, you know, like Bentleys, like expensive sports cars, or like really fancy pens, really fancy watches, yachts. The higher the price, the more demand there is for them. And people will argue, like, oh, well, the reason the price of a newer yacht is higher isn't just because, you know, people want to pay more for them to signal their status. It's because they have more features in them. But, like, I mean, have you ever heard of the features that are on, like, a billion-dollar yacht? They have, like, a submarine. They have missile defense systems. They have, like, three helipads. These are not things that people need, like, in any... like, rational sense of the term.
I totally agree.
Yeah, it's
totally
really just to signal your status. That's the
only
reason.
When I was living in the Caribbean, I had Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, mm-hmm. He had one of his super luxury yachts basically parked just off the island there where everyone could keep a close eye on it. It was called the Tatouche. And... We had several requests every day to take jet skis out. I was working as a beach boy, the cabana boy kind of thing, renting out jet skis and snorkel equipment and that kind of stuff. And so every day we'd have people requesting that we go and take them close to the yacht so that they can take a closer look to it. And I'm never going to forget the day that I actually managed to speak to one of the guys that worked on the ship, yacht, luxury yacht, whatever you want to call it. And it turns out he had three separate recording studios because of his love for country music. He had a full-on cinema. Attached to the super luxury yacht was another yacht that could be lowered into the water for days when he actually wanted to do some sailing. There was a helicopter on board. There were these crane-like arms on the back of the yacht with which he could lower the multiple Sea-Doos that were mounted on. He had a fishing trawler on. So you had the yacht mounted on the one side of the yacht, and on the other side of the yacht you had a fishing trawler. Like, the things that were attached to these super luxury yachts that just serve no actual functional purpose for something like that other than signaling status were fascinating.
And these yachts have full-time staff. Like, they have to have a crew. Like, you can't drive it yourself.
The guy that I was speaking to was a sous chef on board. Oh yeah, no, because the kitchen on board the yacht was on par with pretty much any five-star restaurant that you might go to anywhere in the world.
So yeah, bigger than your kitchen, you fucking peasants.
Oh, hells yeah. I'd say it's probably as big as the flat I live in right now, which is pretty much the biggest flat I've ever lived in.
Like, the kitchen is, or the yacht is?
Oh, no. The kitchen on that yacht is bigger than this apartment that I live in.
Jesus Christ.
Like, way bigger. But now this brings me to another interesting one, and I just want you to sort of confirm whether or not this would fall under Veblen Goods. And by Veblen Goods, I'm assuming that these are named after Thorstein Veblen?
Yes.
Okay. So, for those who don't know, go read up on Thorstein Veblen, some fascinating political economy. So, before I moved out to the Middle East, my uncle came to visit me. Now, he lived in Switzerland at the time, and he'd gotten into some exclusive circles in Europe chatting to some pretty wealthy people. His wife works for a big Swiss bank. And when he got to South Africa and he came to visit me, one of the things that he asked me was to find old marbles. And I was completely perplexed by this concept. Yeah, and it turned out that he was very specifically looking for a set of marbles that were made in the late 50s by a master marbler. I don't know what they're actually called. But it was this German dude, a Swiss-German dude, who hand-blown marbles that were... He only made a limited amount of, like, 150 or something. And apparently these marbles have an extreme value of like close to €1 million each.
Supply and demand, folks.
Supply and demand. So, yeah. Would this qualify as a Veblen good?
I would think so. I mean, the thing that qualifies it is that as price goes up, demand goes up. That's like the main criterion.
Yeah, this is one of those things, is every time one of these marbles goes on auction anywhere in the world, the higher the prices that they're being offered at, the higher the bidding ratios. And so this is why my uncle was like, please, if you hear of anyone that's got any marbles, get in touch with me. I want to be able to sell these to an auction house. And so... There's another example of a Veblen good. Yeah. Sorry, this has actually been bothering me for about 3 years now. So,
So the other good that violates the law of demand is Giffen good. I don't remember who this is named after. It's a lot less common. Although I would suspect if someone actually tried to do a study to like see how much of these goods exist, it would probably be higher than we think. The main example is potatoes during the Irish famine. So basically, yeah. What makes it a Giffen good is, again, as price goes up, demand goes up. But rather than being for signaling status, this is more in the category of necessity. So as the price of potatoes went up during the Irish famine, because there was the blight that wiped out, you know, a ton of the supply of potatoes, people bought more potatoes as a percentage of the food that they bought. And that's because potatoes are the staple food. They need them more than any other food. So because they have a limited income to spend on food, the price of potatoes going up meant that they were less able to afford other types of food besides potatoes. So they would stop consuming anything else and just buy more potatoes in order to make up for their staple food needs. Yeah.
Wow.
So those are the two classes of goods that violate the law of demand.
Okay, so just for reference purposes, because this kind of thing bothers me, the guy who first spoke about Giffen goods was Alfred Marshall, who spoke about it in his book Principles of Economics, and he attributed the idea to Sir Robert Giffen.
Okay.
Okay, that's just for those that like to research stuff after.
Good to know.
Okay, we've got these odd goods that don't obey the law of supply and demand, but your more usual products, I suppose, if we want to refer to them as normal, they're supposed to reach an equilibrium. Tell us more about that.
Basically, the idea is that the supply and demand and price of goods all sort of tug at one another, so that the variation in supply changes the price changes demand changes the price, and it just keeps going back and forth, but it's supposed to reach this equilibrium point where the market has found the optimal price where the seller is maximizing profit. And of course, the assumptions for this are the usual ones for neoclassical markets, which is there are infinitely many buyers and sellers. Buyers and sellers both have perfect information. Buyers have stable, ordered preferences, which means they know exactly the things that they like. They're in a complete total order, and all products are basically perfectly substitutable. So
this is actually, I mean, if you think about it, this is actually the most ridiculous part of the entire fandangle.
Right, and there's more complex models in economics that relax these assumptions. Like there's like bounded rationality. There's the new version of equilibrium is called DSGE, dynamic stochastic general equilibrium. But these relaxing of the assumptions they're just trying to contend with the reality that none of this is true, like in any meaningful sense.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, let's just be fair here. We now live in an age where we've got more information about pretty much everything available to us at the tip of our fingertips. Just type something into Google, you can find out almost anything, except stuff like Apple's supply chain.
Right, yep.
Or the...
Like the markup on a product. Like how much profit Apple is making.
Yeah. Or let's take it a step further and look at advertising and the fact that they essentially are supposed to be telling you more about the product, but they don't do any of that. They basically use Maslow's hierarchy of needs to manipulate you into buying a particular product without telling you anything, so that they're appealing to you on an emotional level rather than a rational level. They're discouraging any actual research onto the product that you're using.
Yeah, they hide, you know, as much of the information as they can without sabotaging themselves. So, like, you know, I think it's pretty reasonable to say that the average person, if they knew that, like, you know, a Galaxy S4 cost $50 to make and they were selling it for $200, and an iPhone cost $20 to make and they were selling it for $200, people will be like, well, obviously, you know, the Galaxy S4 has got to be better because they're putting more work into it and they're, you know, taking less out. You know, it doesn't totally work like that in reality. You know, Apple's able to have a really low cost of manufacturing their phone because of the power they command over the market, and because they sell so many devices, they're able to get, you know, bigger bulk discounts. But I think it's pretty reasonable that people would not want to just like hand over extra money for a similar product for no reason. That's why there's, you know, one example that I was talking about with my coworkers the other day is when I was 16 to 18, I worked at Best Buy, and our discount there was you pay 5% above cost. So you got I got to see exactly how much markup there was on a product by checking it with my discount. And so they were selling USB cables there for $30. For me, it cost like $250. So there was like, you know, $22 of markup or whatever it was on a USB cable. But at the same time, there was sites like Monoprice where you could buy a USB cable for like $4. So like, why would anyone want to just hand over extra money for no reason? It's dumb. Mm. So you have to hide this information there.
Yeah, it's like, I find this very interesting. I recently purchased a OnePlus 3T,
okay,
which is a Chinese manufacturer.
Uh-huh.
But their entire business model, there's been issues about how they've released their phones on an invite-only basis, that kind of thing, to appeal to exclusivity. But their essential business model is, let's make the phone as good as we possibly can and then sell it for as low as we possibly can while still making a profit. And because of this, a friend that I've made here recently dropped his Samsung Galaxy S7 and
like physically dropped it. Oh, okay, yeah, yeah, all right.
Yeah. And cracked it to hell and gone, and so he's phoning around to the various service providers here to see if he can get himself a deal on a new phone. And the one guy says to him, "Look, I can get you a nice deal on an iPhone 7 Plus." And so he turns to me and he asks me about the iPhone 7 Plus and what do I know about it. So I jump on Google quickly and I ask for a comparison because my only point of reference is my OnePlus 3T. And it turns out that visually, the OnePlus 3T and the iPhone 7 Plus are basically the same size, same screen resolution. My camera on the front and the back of the phone are way superior to the iPhone 7 Plus.
Mm-hmm.
I've got better processing, better internal storage, better expandable storage. I've got a stronger operating system. Pretty much everything about the phone is nearly twice as good as the iPhone 7 Plus. And yet the iPhone 7 Plus is running at double the price.
Oh, wow.
And yeah,
and selling way more units.
Selling way more units. And there's the fact that they're both essentially manufactured in China. So the labor costs are not significantly different. The resource materials are not significantly different. In fact, one would expect the OnePlus 3T, because it is using because it has a stronger specification than the one than the iPhone 7 Plus, you'd expect that the OnePlus 3T has a higher material cost. But clearly, either that isn't the case, or Apple has an insane markup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they do, because
the only logical conclusion.
The last time I checked, like $20 was actually what it cost them to manufacture an iPhone, and I think when I checked it was either the 3GS or the 4, so it's probably gone down or stayed about the same, because you know they're selling even more phones now, and they are probably negotiating better deals. And we'll get into why those differences exist later on. So let's,
okay.
Yeah, we've kind of strayed off track a little bit. Let's get back to equilibrium. So for these founding assumptions, a good resource to learn about how these assumptions have actually been tested in reality and in study is Steve Keen. He's an Australian economist. He talks a lot about how equilibrium theory is loadable, And yeah, check him out. He's got some like video lectures that are good. He's got a book called Debunking Economics. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm definitely gonna check that out.
All right. So the other major problem besides the assumptions behind price equilibrium is like no one can actually tell you when a price is in equilibrium or not. No price really stops at a certain level. If it does fluctuate, because there are some prices that do fluctuate according to supply and demand, and it's mainly things like tickets for seats, like theater shows, like airline flights, things like that. But those prices never reach an equilibrium. They just keep fluctuating ad infinitum. And then the other thing is, prices aren't like some natural phenomenon that we observe. They're values that are created by people. So that means we can readily verify how a price is actually determined. And so studies by Means and Burl and subsequent authors found that supply and demand is just not a common way to set prices. So McDonald's doesn't have someone sit down and figure out how many burgers it has, because first of all, that number is constantly changing, and second, because production can readily scale up or down, and it doesn't figure out how many burgers people are willing to buy. They don't care what the exact number is. They just want to sell as many as they can. So what they do is they take the cost, and then they just add a certain percent markup to it to reach, you know, their expected profit margin. So like the amount of revenue that they want to take in, that they expect to take in according to like the capitalization discount formula, where, you know, it's expected future revenue adjusted for risk. So like the risk that people would not buy as many hamburgers if they raise the price too much. So they just add a percentage to it. And many studies have found that represents at least 75% of all goods sold in Western economies. So in the U.S., it's around there. In France, it was found that it's over 80% of goods are priced that way.
Wow.
If you go into a store, the price of most of the goods there doesn't fluctuate at all. You know, like a USB cable at Best Buy was $30 the entire time that I worked there. It wasn't $30 one day and then like $25 another day. The only time that prices really change is for sales. And, you know, in that case, like, especially in grocery stores, there are products called loss leaders where they actually price them below cost. So they take a loss on them so that on your way to get those cheap things, you'll buy other stuff that has a much higher profit margin on it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So essentially then, what we're saying is that actual prices are nothing more than another level of manipulation in the consuming cycle.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's one way that they're used. You know, not all prices, obviously, are like trying to manipulate people, but they definitely are used to manipulate people's desire to buy things. Another great example of that is called anchoring. And this is actually something they teach in economics, which, you know, baffles me that they're not like, oh, wow, supply or equilibrium is bullshit because of this anchoring thing. This is done a lot in department stores. So what anchoring is they'll put a product, like, on sale. They'll say that it's on sale, and then they'll show you what the original price was. But the original price wasn't necessarily that the day before. And since I was working merchandising at Best Buy, I was actually one of the kids that was, you know, actually changing all the prices in the store. I would go around with a big sheet of stickers and print it out, like perforated sheets, and I would take out all the old price tags and put the new ones in. And so a lot of times I would see something that said it was on sale, where like the day before it would be like a phone for $50, and then the tag I would replace it with would be like, you know, mobile phone, original price, $100, on sale, $50. So they're like making you think you're getting a great deal, but it's they're actually just like lying about what the original price was.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That's insane. And I mean, It's not like people go out on a daily basis or a weekly basis or even a monthly basis to buy these products so that they're aware of these price manipulations.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if you go grocery shopping, it's a slightly different case, and they're unlikely to run that sort of scam, essentially, because that's exactly what it is. Okay, so, that sort of leads me into another question.
Okay.
How do regulations affect this equilibrium of supply and demand and price?
Yeah, so the, conventional wisdom about it is that regulations are essentially a distortion on price, and there are various perspectives on, you know, whether or not this is okay. The libertarian ANCAP Austrian perspective on it would be these distortions are fundamentally immoral, or even that these distortions are the reason that things are unaffordable to poor people, and that if all regulations were gotten rid of, we would all be middle class and have all necessities fulfilled. We would all get paid a bunch of money for our jobs, and everything would be great. But there's also the more less insane perspective on it, which is that some distortions are in fact necessary in order to ensure that poor people aren't starving in the streets, that kind of thing. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
It does. I just want to point out that although we do see our libertarian brothers and sisters as normal human beings, we will never, ever, ever use Mises.org as a valid source of information.
I'm kind of up on that bottom unity type thing. You know, I think libertarians and ANCAPs do have some good ideas. I think they're definitely right about, you know, we should get rid of states. Totally all about that. But this whole idea of economics, nah. Sorry.
Yeah.
And I also do agree that some regulations are oppressive, that Byzantine regulations and licensing arrangements do prevent a lot of people from establishing businesses that would be fine otherwise.
Mm.
There's one more aspect of prices that I didn't mention while Peter and I were recording initially, and it would really bother me if I didn't bring this up, but there's something called charm prices. Everyone has seen this before. Instead of something being priced at $16, it's priced at $15.99. So the reason that that's done is because through our cognitive biases, we perceive $15.99 as being closer to $15 than $16, and so it's been found that people are more likely to buy something when it's $15.99 than when it's $16. And there's been studies showing the distribution of the least significant digit on prices, and 5 and 9 are overwhelmingly the most common, with 9 being, I think, twice as common as 5. So yeah, that's one last thing I wanted to add.
This is a little excerpt from Investopedia, and so this is just kind of an illustration of how Investopedia authors think prices and people work. So I'm going to start reading here. Imagine that a special edition CD of your favorite band is released for $20. Because a record company's previous analysis showed that customers will not demand CDs at a price higher than $20, only 10 CDs were released because the opportunity cost is too high for suppliers to produce more. If, however, the 10 CDs are demanded by 20 people, the price will subsequently rise because according to the demand relationship, as demand increases, so does the price. Consequently, the rise in price should prompt more CDs to be supplied, as the supply relationship shows that the higher the price, the higher the quantity supplied. If, however, there are 30 CDs produced and demand is still at 20, the price will not be pushed up because the supply more than accommodates demand. In fact, after the 20 consumers have been satisfied with their CD purchases, the price of the leftover CDs may drop as CD producers attempt to sell the remaining 10 CDs. The lower price will then make the CD more available to people who had previously decided the opportunity cost of buying the CD at $20 was too high. So
that's oh my god. So do these people over at Investopedia, do they ever actually like look at reality, or is it always these hypothetical ridiculous situations?
I don't think any of these people have ever listened to a CD before, let alone bought one. Like, there's no way.
Okay. Like, the reason I ask is I can't remember who it was now. I remember that there was a controversy about copper and how copper had been stockpiled in order to affect prices.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't remember who it was or who was involved with the whole thing. But it was a pretty big deal. And I think it relates very closely to this. If I'm a supplier and I want to determine what I want the demand to be, then all I have to do, according to Investopedia, is manipulate my supply.
Right. There's just so many things in this passage that signal that these writers have, like, first of all, never worked at a real business, have, like, no idea how CD sales actually work, like, that this example is not something that they observed, it's just something that they thought of as a thought experiment and then wrote down as if it were actually reality. Because, for one...
Who buys two CDs? Who does that?
Not even that. The thing that jumped out at me first was they only released 10 CDs. Like, that's complete fucking madness. Even one of my favorite bands, Natural Snow Buildings, they record a ton of stuff, they DIY everything, and their special edition releases are 500 CDs. And that's most common, like, special, like, limited edition release lot size is 500. You know, it'll go anywhere between 500 and 2,000. But the fact that they said 10, like, when, like, we're not even doing math here. There's no math that's being done. So it's not like having a higher number would make it more difficult to understand.
Yeah, the manufacturer basically sits back and goes, look, dude, my machine, in order to switch it on, I need to pump out a minimum of 500. So I don't really care what your demand is. Yeah. You're getting 500 CDs. That's it.
Well, and the limited edition release that I'm talking about was on CDRs. So this isn't like, you know, a record pressing plant where, like, you know, it's a big industrial business making these CDs. It's like someone sticking a blank CD into a CD burner and then, like, painting on it with paint. That's what they did. Huh? And they still released 500 of them. But, like, the idea that an actual, like, business is going to release 10 CDs makes no fucking sense. Like, there's no way that they would make any money on that. Because, like, industrial machines, the whole point is that they make a lot of one thing repeatedly. And that is the thing that lowers the price.
Yeah, look, even in your example, for CDRs, in order to produce those CDRs, the most logical thing, if they're busy, obviously they're already going with a low budget option.
Mm-hmm.
In order to keep that budget low, they will buy a spindle of 500 CDs.
Right.
They're not going to go out and buy a single CD in a case. Oh, can I have 10 of those and another 10 of those? And that's not how it works. So clearly, the Investopedia seems to be a bit disassociated from reality.
Yeah, and, you know, there's this big issue that I think is very common that isn't really talked about a whole lot, which is that, you know, economists are trying to describe how businesses work, but they have never worked in a real, like, their job has always been economist. So they've never worked in an actual business and, like, observed for themselves how it works.
Mm.
A lot of the times they're just reading previous economists' work and then, you know, building on top of it. And rarely does that involve observing how businesses work in practice or anything like that. You know, they're either looking at statistics or they're looking at theory and applying theory to how they think reality works.
Yeah. No, look, I don't mean to be funny here, but the way that this reads, I'm looking at the Investopedia article that you've just read from. And the way that it reads is like a first-year economics student was asked to write an essay describing the supply and demand of a specific product, and they had to come up with something in theory, and that this essay was then actually used to give people business advice.
Right.
It's the most ludicrous kind of setup I've ever even seen. It's amateurish at best. At best.
And then,
I'm being generous.
I guess since opportunity cost is being mentioned again, we should just talk a small amount about it. Opportunity cost is this idea that any decision you make can be either, you know, the most optimal decision to maximize your the return on your expenditures, or it can be suboptimal. And so what they're saying is that if they were to produce 11 CDs, they would be making less of a return for the amount of money that they were spending to produce the 10 CDs. But like, there's no way to calculate that. Like, no one can say, oh, if we spend, if we make 11 CDs, then this is the number of dollars that we're going to make. There's no way to predict that. And no one has the job of calculating this number, because it's fucking impossible.
Yeah, you literally have to go and run with a counterfactual universe in which you've got a billion variables in order to do an actual opportunity costing like that.
Right.
And so, in essence, it starts to look more like opportunity cost than is essentially just a bunch of made-up bullshit to use as an excuse for choosing one rate of return over another rate of return, which is essentially the same. But usually, I think personally, I was running multiple events at the same time a few weeks ago, where I had a limited set of lighting options that I had to use at one of the events, and then my other event asked me for the same kind of lighting setup, and I now had this decision to make. Which one is going to cost me more? Where am I going to make the most money? And the most logical option was to go to another lighting supplier, get more lights, and do both of them at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So this notion of opportunity cost affecting prices, in my opinion, it's ludicrous and stupid, and based on the lack of collaborative and cooperative businesses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I don't know if you noticed, they also apply it to the consumer. So they think that the logic that someone uses to decide whether or not to buy a CD is, if I spend $20 on a CD, will it maximize my pleasure? Like, nobody thinks that way, except for economists.
No.
And that's the other thing, is like,
no, but if
like, everybody doesn't think the same way. So you can't say that this is the logic that people are using in order to decide whether or not to buy something, because
no, but
everyone uses different logic.
Ryan, I don't think that you understand. If you're spending $20 on a CD and I can get that same CD at $10, then I have $10 that I can then convert into coins that I can then bathe in. And I don't think you understand this whole maximizing of pleasure.
All right, so I think we've spent enough time on supply and demand.
And the traditional explanation.
Yeah. Hot takes here.
Hot take. Religiosity is directly correlated with having a chafed asshole. That's why in Japan and France, where bidets are more common, they're very secular.
So do you think that if we were to institute like a nationalized program of giving out bidets in the U.S. that people would stop believing in angels?
My only problem with that notion is the fact that I don't trust your average Christian conservative in the US to understand what a bidet is, and they're probably just going to end up trying to drink out of the toilet.
or they would just be too repressed to use it. Like, it would like give them a feeling on their butthole, and then, that would
oh
be sinful.
No, I think the bigger risk in the US is that Coca-Cola will decide that the bidet is actually to be used as a soda fountain, and they will be selling Coca-Cola in the bathrooms.
To be fair, I think if you used a bidet with Coca-Cola, it would probably like sanitize your butthole, so it would actually be healthier. But then it's maybe actually the sugar would give you a yeast infection, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's actually hilarious because for years, I used to once a month buy a can of Coca-Cola and pour it into the cistern of the toilet and do 10-minute quick flushes of the toilet, and by the end of it, you have the cleanest fucking toilet in the world. So, for a proper butthole cleanse, go to Coca-Cola.
Hot take. The degeneracy narrative is nothing more than an effort to rationalize being a lame, easily triggered dork by framing it as some wider social concern, as if there's this chain of indirect causation from not being a thoroughly uninteresting dullard to an actual decline in material social conditions. And there's more to it than just wanting everyone to be as boring and weak as you. My favorite part of this degeneracy narrative is that it includes wanting to be a woman or dress like a woman as degenerate, but does not include sitting in a basement watching a stream of someone else play a video game where they're a virtual woman in a skimpy woman's outfit.
I'm sorry, I love it. I love it so much.
So, now that we've talked about the boring conventional idea of how prices work, we can move on to you know, what the show kind of focuses on, which is the unusual ideas of how prices work. So the first one I'll talk about is the theory, and this is very rare, that prices represent embodied energy content. And so if you don't know what that means, basically any good or service has to have a certain amount of energy put into it. And, you know, in our world, that mostly means fossil fuels. So the embodied energy content of a product is like, you know, the number of kilowatt hours or joules that it took to actually make that product and get it into your hands. So there's a theory that the price of a good is directly related to the embodied energy content. And this actually makes quite a bit of sense. The price of oil is pretty controlled. It's not stable, but because everything does require energy to make and package and deliver, there is certainly, you know, some amount of truth to that. What it doesn't account for is markup, of course.
Yeah.
But you know,
there's a level of subjectivity to services as opposed to goods. Mm-hmm. And look, I think I originally, the first time I spoke to anyone about embodied energy in as a pricing mechanism, I was busy talking to a bunch of technocrats.
Okay.
For those that don't know about technocracy, it was a very popular movement back in the 1920s and 30s, which became very unpopular very quickly when people started speaking to the leaders of that movement, and it turned out that they were actually a little bit on the racist side, a little bit...
Yeah, they were eugenicists, weren't they?
Yeah, pretty much. They wanted an isolationist North America. It just turned out that they figured scientists would make the best leaders by virtue of being smarter than everyone else.
Fucking nerds.
And that they want... Yeah, they just wanted to breed more smart people, and they figured that that's the best way to run society.
Yeah.
And look, there's a lot of people that would agree with that kind of narrative, but...
Especially now that Idiocracy's come out.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, what that energy accounting doesn't account for is the fact that different services have, even though they might be in the same industry, there are specific niches that the energy accounting can't account for. One designer might have more flair for femininity than another designer who focuses more on hard corporate kind of stylized designs. And obviously then, for a feminist magazine, neither one of those two is really going to fit into what it is that they're looking to do. And so the nuance of the service can't be accounted for by doing a material costing of the energy involved. So while I like the idea of energy accounting, while it is more rational, certainly, than the current completely subjective, crappy supply and demand pricing systems, there are obviously still strong limitations with embodied energy.
Yep. And so for this price representing embodied energy theory, I did see a study, I think it was back in 2012, I'm just guessing, that it did have some good empirical evidence for it. And I was thinking about what I said just before about how it doesn't account for markup. And I guess the answer to that would be that that markup is taken and spent on other things. And eventually, like, all the costs kind of cancel out, so that it would represent energy, embodied energy, pretty well, but only in the aggregate. And so the evidence that I saw was actually related to GDP. So it would, you know, it would fit that narrative perfectly, where GDP sort of represents the amount spent on everything, like all transactions. And so that it would be very likely, I think, that it would equal the amount of energy spent once all the profits are canceled out by expenditures of the profits.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find that study. I've looked pretty hard, but was not able to find it.
Yeah. Are you sure it actually happened, or this wasn't just maybe something that you imagined because you needed it?
Yeah, maybe something I inhaled. I don't know. So the next one I'll go into is time banking. And this one is like a real thing that actually exists. One way to think about differences in wages and the expenditure of money is that when you spend money, you're converting the amount of time, like you get paid a certain amount for a certain number of hours worked. So if you work 8 hours and you get $100 and someone else is willing to spend an hour working for you, but instead of, you know, getting paid whatever, you know, 1/8 of $100, they get 1/8 of, you know, like $30, you're basically commanding more of their time for less of your time. So like, instead of trading an hour of your time for an hour of their time, which is what time banking is, you're trading like, you know, 5 minutes of your time for an hour of their time. And so it creates this big hierarchy of whoever gets paid the most has like the most command over others. And and it's kind of a, you know, pretty unfair system, especially because, you know, it has this illusion of meritocracy, but obviously, you know, it doesn't really function that way.
Yeah. Also, this is not a very new idea.
Right. It's actually very old. I think it started in the beginning of the 20th century, or maybe earlier.
No, as far as I know, it started with the American anarchist Josiah Warren. When he we're talking back in 1827, 1830, there or thereabouts. I remember reading about the Cincinnati Time Store.
Oh yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and he basically it was a very strict interpretation of the labor theory of value, and a lot of people would consider it the very first experiment in mutualism.
Right.
And essentially, what they did there is he came up with this policy of cost is the limit of price.
Yes.
And that there would be no profit over and above the cost as calculated.
Mm-hmm.
And that in essence, you had labor hours as a currency. And the Cincinnati Times store kind of acted as both a store where you could purchase goods and a swapping kind of market where people could come in and trade a kind of IOU, which was these currency notes that would entitle you to 1 hour's labor or 2 hours' labor or 3 hours' labor or whatever it came down to at the time. So, yeah.
Yeah, and so, I think, you know, our goods now, the cost of a good is essentially the amount of money that it takes to mobilize people to create that good. So the amount of time it takes to, you know, mine the materials, to transport those materials to be processed, to process them, to shape them into the product, to package the product, to deliver the product to you, that all goes into the cost. And so for time banking, it would work exactly the same way. It would just be that instead of in being in dollars, it would be in hours. So if it takes, you know, like 1,000 person hours to make an iPhone, then it would cost 1,000 hours. So there's actually a modern time bank that exists on the web called Time Republic, and it's Time Republic with a K. So you can actually do time banking if you want. You just go to Time Republic and sign up there. You can offer services. It unfortunately is only services for that, and that's mainly just because it's much easier to deal with that. In order to sell goods on a time banking system, you would have to have like an entire supply chain set up to make that good using only hours. But you can go on there and, you know, have someone come fix your computer or fix your bike or something like that and pay them in hours.
It's actually very interesting. While you're talking about it, I realized that the one non-physical good that could be produced that way is an animated movie. You know, you look at the original Disney animated movies and how many hours it took for artists to sit and do the animations by hand. And how the moment that companies like Pixar came out, suddenly you had these, they would start talking about how many computer hours were involved in the production of the movie. And then you're starting to talk in the hundreds of thousands and the millions of hours. And obviously it didn't take millions of hours, it's just the processing time and everything. And I'm wondering how that would relate to time banking.
Right. So that's where it gets kind of complicated, because especially for something like a movie, even if you're only accounting for person hours, you know, if it takes a million person hours to make the movie, how do you divide that up to all the viewers? Because like the more viewers that you would have, you know, the
lower the price.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, you can't at the beginning, because people are not going to all view it at the same time. You're not going to get like a billion people watching Sleeping Beauty all at once. So that's where it gets complicated and difficult, which is why I just think that, you know, prices in general are just not a good idea.
Yeah, so I think that the reason I brought this up, sorry, I should have been a little clearer, is that the movie industry kind of illustrates why time banking is, it would be overly complicated.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many levels of nuance involved with calculating people's time that to try and implement a system like that at anything larger than a very small community scale becomes unfeasible.
Yeah, and then if you introduce things like value chains, you know, the value chain is an economic concept where like, you know, the animators and programmers on a Pixar movie, they would be the people that are like physically actually making the movie, but they're not the only ones that work at the company. There's also, you know, office workers, accountants, I'm sure there's lawyers there, there's managers, janitors, and they all contribute to the running of the company, but they're not directly contributing to the actual manufacture of the product. They're not physically involved in it.
Yeah, and now and then we haven't even gotten into the directors, the performers themselves, and those are not set prices either. Those people are busy with other projects as well, and they have to manage their time.
Yeah, they can be working on multiple things at once. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Way too complicated.
Right, and so like Marxists call this like productive versus unproductive value, but it's just a silly term, like, because like the company could not be productive without the labor, without the unproductive labor.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's time banking.
Okay. I know that you've got a slightly different take on value theories than most other people.
Yes.
Maybe you want to talk us through that.
Okay. So, you know, I've talked about supply and demand and time banking and embodied energy. There's also labor theory of value, which I won't get into because...
It's pseudoscience?
Yeah, it's kind of pseudoscience. It's kind of true at the same time. Like, I actually have this theory. You know, there was the switch, like, probably around the beginning of the 20th century. I haven't looked into the exact numbers because I don't want to prove myself wrong on this. But there was a switch from labor theory of value being the predominant theory in political economy to subjective theory of value. And my perspective on that switch is the main obstacle for a business to sell something prior to the 20th century was whether or not someone could make it themselves in less time than it would take for them to work for a wage and pay for it. Nobody would have wanted to buy a pair of shoes in the 18th or 19th century because most people were able to like make a pair of shoes by themselves in about 2 hours. And it would take like at least a full day of work to be able to afford a pair of shoes from a factory, and they were generally lower quality products coming from factories as well. And then in the 20th century, you know, everyone was working for a wage. There was not really any kind of self-provision happening. There was a significant enough level of de-skilling going on that the main obstacle to selling a good was, you know, just the subjective value of it, the perceived value of what you were getting for the price. So that's all I'll talk about with labor theory of value, because I'm not that super familiar with it. I know the basic issues of it, but if any Marxist listens to this and hears me talking about labor theory of value, they're going to be like, no, you don't know what you're talking about. Shut the fuck up.
Well, look, I don't claim to be an expert either. My only problem with labor theory of value is that, from my understanding, Marxists have gone and said that you've got two different kinds of labor. One is productive, the other is unproductive. But at no point can they really boil it down and give me a solid enough definition of the different kinds of labor that I can then go and empirically investigate everything.
Right. And we actually did go into the problems with that a little bit. So, yeah.
Exactly. So, like, when I say that it's pseudoscience, I don't mean to insult people. I mean to point out the fact that I don't find empirical value in it. Just to clarify.
Right. Yeah. And there's actually a third type of labor, which is dead labor. But let's move on from labor theory of value.
Agreed.
It wasn't even just a Marxist thing. It was actually, you know, common in classical political economy. But we don't really need to talk about it anymore. So my conception of price, and I won't say value because I think one of the big issues with theories of value is their conflation of value and price. So there's this idea that that a price measures the value of an object, but there's numerous reasons that we've talked about already during the show of why price doesn't really represent the value of an item. A lot of times it, you know, factors in a lot of other things. So I think that supply and demand is correct to an extent within a certain limited context. I think labor theory of value is correct within a certain context. Embodied energy, like all the theories of value are correct. The problem is they're trying to describe like a unified theory of how prices are formed that only accounts for a singular logic that determines every sort of price. So I've actually discovered the correct singular logic for how all prices are formed. And it's essentially what the price setter has the power to charge. So this includes supply and demand. It includes labor. It includes, you know, productive and unproductive labor, because it doesn't depend on, you know, just the people that are literally manufacturing the thing, but also all the people that are being paid. And it includes this reality of most prices are just the cost of the good plus a certain amount of markup, because the amount of markup that they can set on it is largely determined by a power process. So the reason that Apple can mark up their phones by $180
and OnePlus can only mark up their phones by, you know, less, or that they only do, because this isn't like a deterministic thing. This isn't like the price setter will set the price to the maximum amount that they possibly can given the power that they have. It also accounts for other factors that go into the decision-making process, because it's at the end, it's humans setting the prices, and humans have a lot of different motivations. They aren't just deterministic automata. They're actual people. But there is a certain floor and ceiling of what people can set prices to be, and the main factor that determines those things are power. So the way that supply and demand fits into that is, if a good has a lot of demand, that means that you have the power to set the price higher, because there will be people that will be willing to spend more on it, even though it's the same product. So, like, I can go into this example later, because I'm going to read an excerpt from an article. Like, Broadway tickets, because there are people who are willing to spend a ton of money on Broadway tickets, that means that the people that are selling the tickets have the power to charge quite a lot. And so as the demand goes up for them, that does give them more leeway to set a higher price. Now, that doesn't mean that if the demand goes up, then they definitely will set a higher price, because there's no reason that that needs to be true. And then for the floor of the price, that's largely a function of the labor that goes into it. So, like, let's look at the difference between, you know, a factory worker in the United States and a factory worker in Thailand. The Thai factory worker is obviously going to be cheaper to make the same good. It's not because demand for their labor is less or that the supply is higher. It's just because they have less literal political power to demand more money as compared to someone in the U.S. First of all, there's minimum wage, so you can't legally pay a factory worker less than $7.25 anywhere in the country. And then there's the precedent of what factory workers make. So, you know, they make a certain wage level, and they're not going to work for substantially lower than that. And then, you know, in the U.S., more so in the past, but still today, there's unions, which means there's collective bargaining happening. So if in an industry that's not unionized, like fast food, if someone were to demand $15 an hour to work a fast food job, then they could find a bunch of other people that are willing to work for a lot less than that. And so they can just tell that person to go and, you know, suck an egg, and then they aren't going to get the job. But in the case of unions, the union collectively demands $15 an hour, and if they don't want to pay that much, then they have to either get someone to scab, or, you know, they have to deal with the union, because no one in the union is going to agree to work for them if they don't meet their demands.
Okay.
Yeah. So does that make sense so far?
It does. It does.
Yeah, so I think that covers the basic gist of it. You know, any of these theories of value that we have do factor into the price in some way, because they affect the power of the buyer and the seller.
Mm. I mean, I definitely don't think that existing theories of value, as they are related to price, I don't think that people, economists and business people specifically, understand that the relationship isn't as strong as they think it is.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it becomes quite obvious when we start to find all these discrepancies. It becomes quite obvious then that the theory of valuation that is being applied should, if the causation is as strong as these economists and the business people think, then we should be seeing empirical results that 100% match across the board. But that simply isn't the case. A lot of the studies that have been done show that economics is considered a soft science, specifically because it's a lot of the hypotheses are very untestable. The test results for studies that have been done show weak correlations at best, and very often negative correlations, stuff that goes completely counter to the theories being put across. So, yeah, I have many, many problems with existing theories of value.
Yeah, and so one of the great things about this framework is, you know, we've only been talking about the prices of products and services and like wages. I mean, we've talked very little about wages, but we've spent almost the entire time talking about the price of goods. And the beauty of this is that it actually applies to any price. So not just the price of a good, but things that aren't conventionally thought of as prices, such as fines and fees. So fines are like the biggest one for me. So if you speed and you get caught by a cop, then the cop's going to write you a ticket and you're going to have to pay like, you know, $100, $200. That is a factor of power. So if they were to try and charge people $1,000 for speeding, then there would be quite a bit of backlash and they would have to reduce the amount. But, you know, if they're charging, you know, $100 or $200, they have the power to do that because they're the government. And so if you don't pay it, they're going to escalate the penalty to something else. And so, again, it's not a deterministic thing. You know, we can't say that, like, the government has X power, so it will charge Y for a speeding ticket. But it explains why and how they can charge the amount that they do for speeding or any other penalty.
Okay.
So I guess I can go back and explain what made me think of this. Yeah, you and I met through the Zeitgeist movement, and through that I quickly became kind of obsessed with how the economy actually works and how it could work if we didn't have money. And in reading into how the economy actually works, you know, I found these concepts that a lot of us know run in the same circles, like externalities, which are factors that are costs but that aren't factored into prices. So like gas is much cheaper than it should technically be because companies don't pay for pollution. And so it was bothering me for a long time, like why that was the case and how could we explain that, because economists just kind of say, oh, it's an externality. Yeah, that's it. Sorry. It doesn't factor into the price, but they just call it like a distortion and move on. But for me, I wanted to understand why it wasn't factored into the price. So that, again, is part of this power explanation. So the reason that pollution isn't factored into the price of gasoline is because no one has the power to force them to pay that cost. So let's say for an individual person, you know, the amount of damage done by a gallon of gas to the atmosphere is like some negligible amount of money that doesn't even equal a penny. And that would be like, you know, for 1 gallon of gas, like overall, let's say it does a penny worth of damage to the atmosphere. So you take that and then you have to factor in the fact that we all share the atmosphere. And so you have to divide by, you know, 7 billion people or whatever you want, whatever scope you want to set it to. So it affects us very little individually and per like unit cost. And so the only way that we could really force them to pay for that is either to get the government to set a law forcing them to pay for it, in which case they would probably go elsewhere or something, or, you know, just eat it. And it would also require us to organize politically and fight the resistance from the oil company, which has considerable power in the government as well. Or we would have to sue them, and it would be the same kind of thing, except, you know, instead of organizing politically, we would be paying a lot of money to get a legal team and win court cases. So the benefit to doing that, I mean, obviously, like, in the long run and in the aggregate is substantial, but, you know, for a gallon of gas, not really so. The amount of damage that it does is minor compared to the amount of, that we would have to spend in order to make that happen. And so, you know, the oil company can just say, well, we're not paying for the damage done by pollution because who's going to stop us?
Okay, so let's just also take into account the fact that these multinational corporations and energy companies and so on, they're not stupid. You know, they go do their cost-benefit analysis and they look at it and say, well, so if we get caught polluting this river, we're going to get $10 billion fine.
Which in reality is much lower than that.
Oh yeah,
not
yeah,
even
yeah, yeah.
close.
But yeah, I'm busy thinking of BP's Gulf oil spills.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it's $10 billion if we get caught, and if we go to court, and if our lawyers fail, we're going to end up paying a large amount of money. However, in that same time period, if we were to just carry on with business, we're going to make at least $150 billion in profit. Mm-hmm. And so it's a no-brainer from a purely numbers perspective.
Right.
Then we've also got to look at it from a slightly different perspective and say, okay, so now the BP oil spill happens and they get caught and they go to court and they lose and they get a fine of, I think it was like $3 billion in total. Mm-hmm. But you can't purchase that ecological system.
Yeah.
You can't fix it.
Right.
I mean, the latest studies have shown that the oil sitting at the bottom of the Gulf has created this thick, sludgy layer that has killed off a lot of the ecology in the region. And there's no way to reconstitute that. So,
and what's
even
worse
if we were
is that the efforts that they actually made to clean up the spill by using detergents, the animals that were cleaned up with detergents had an even lower survival rate than the ones that were just covered in oil. So they actually did more damage trying to fix it than they did with the initial spill.
And this is a common problem when it comes to trying to make companies include externalities into their pricing structures. First of all, they can do the cost-benefit analysis and say, well, fine, we'll swallow it.
Yeah.
Or second of all, they, from the outside perspective, these accounting practices for externalities don't actually mitigate or reverse the problems being caused. I mean, when we're looking at carbon taxing for industries in order to reduce carbon emissions for global warming, for Paris climate accords, all of it's really just political posturing. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, we've reached almost a point of no return. And trying to account for these externalities doesn't work in the way that the politicians and the big business leaders, I use that sarcastically as I possibly can, it doesn't work. It doesn't have the desired effect.
Right. And even in your example, your hypothetical, even if the cost and the benefit were very similar, like, you know, it could cost them $3 billion if they spill oil and they're caught and fined, if their fine is supposed to be $3 billion and they're supposed to make $3 billion from doing that, there's also like the risk factor where they aren't necessarily going to get caught and the oil isn't necessarily going to spill. So they can discount the cost by that amount of risk to say that, like, oh, well, you know, if we discount the risk, then it really only costs us, like, you know, $500 million, and we'll make $3 billion. And so it's still beneficial to them to actually just go through with it.
Yeah. Yeah, at the end of the day, I look at the existing systems and I weep.
And, so the other thing that really bothered me, and if I remember correctly, this really bothered you too, was the paradox of value. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I remember it clearly.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, the paradox of value is this very old paradox in economics, which is intuitively, you know, a gallon of water is much more valuable to us than a diamond. We can't really do anything with a diamond. It's kind of useless. The only time that diamonds are even like worth anything in a utilitarian sense is if they're dust, they can be used as a grinding surface. But diamonds are basically useless other than that. They're pretty, people like them, but they don't have any like utilitarian purpose. And water is the opposite. It's completely necessary for life. You cannot survive more than a couple of days without water. Water is used in almost every industrial process that exists. You know, it's used for cooling, it's used for cleaning, obviously it's used for food and water, beverages, everything. Everything depends on water. It's probably the single most important thing, material on the planet. But water is priced much more cheaply than diamonds are. And this is even, you know, accounting for the fact that there's a diamond cartel that raises the price of diamonds by stockpiling them. Even without that, you know, it would still cost more for a diamond than for a gallon of water. So that
I just want to be clear about something. And I know you said that diamonds aren't actually all that useful. This isn't strictly true.
Okay.
In the industrial world, they are used for everything from speaker domes. They can be used to treat poisoning and disease in the medical field. There are certain kinds of windows that use diamond membranes to strengthen them. They're used as abrasives, as heat sinks. They're used in the engraving process. There's an entire range of uses for them. However, with the advent of carbon nanotubes and graphene, a lot of the uses for diamonds, with all these new nanomaterials that are coming out now, diamonds are being phased out. So now we're literally looking at a situation where even if people want to argue that diamonds do have wide variety of uses, they now have been rendered essentially useless, other than pretty little rocks. And we get back to the actual value paradox. I just wanted to bring that up because I got into a big discussion with someone the other day. They wanted to start out by pointing out that I am a De Beers, which is historically related to De Beers diamonds, although obviously you know that the De Beers family has nothing to do with the De Beers diamond cartel, which has been broken up since. But because of the discussion of diamonds, they wanted to argue with me that diamonds are essential to industry, and there's an obvious reason why it gets priced higher than water.
Okay.
And I basically had to rip his argument apart by showing that everything that diamonds are used for, there are alternative materials that are cheaper and more effective, and diamonds are actually being phased out of most industries.
Okay, so I stand corrected on that, but you know the core of the point still stands,
the
which
principle,
is that water is used in even more industrial processes, and it's essential to us in so many more ways. And this paradox of value problem has existed for, I'm certain, longer than you know almost any of these uses that we're talking about have been around, because this is a really old problem. And I'm sure that a lot of these uses for diamonds happened, you know, fairly recently, probably in the last century. So yeah, that was the other thing that bothered me. And so this kind of resolves the paradox of value in a way that isn't just like, oh, well, all value is subjective, so you know, whatever price happens, that's what it is. It's sort of the fact that because water is so easily attainable by anyone, you know, because there's so many alternative sources for it, which isn't necessarily to say that the supply is higher. It's not the fact that the supply is higher that makes this a fact, but that, you know, water falls from the sky. So if you want to collect water, you can. That makes it lower priced. And the fact that diamonds have to be mined, and that mines are generally privately owned, and that there's this cartel around it, or there was anyway, that's what makes the price of diamonds higher. And it's not that they're more valuable, because they aren't more valuable. It's that theories of value don't explain price at all. You have to have a theory of price to explain price, not a theory of value.
Yeah, the conflation is never ending.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's everything that I wanted to cover with regard to that.
Okay. So our podcast is called Labor Science, and I just realized that a lot of people probably don't understand what we mean when we talk about labor science. So just to explain in more or less the same way that Morty Bookcheek would have explained it, labor science is a critique of current bank magic and anti-neighborhood trends, and it talks about rebuilding the neighborhood without ignoring nature, by talking to your neighbors and working with them so that bank magic doesn't get to control society.
I think that's a pretty good explanation.
I think so too.
Thanks for listening in. That was episode 3. If you already know who we are, then you already know what we do. If not, go to our website, postscarcitymagazine.com. We do not only this podcast, but I've been running a post-scarcity zine for about 2 years now. There's currently 4 issues, currently working on the 5th. If you like us, please subscribe to us on Stitcher or iTunes, or just go to my website. You can download the show there if you want. If you think we're good, then leave us a review on iTunes. That helps us get more people listening in. You know, tell your friends about it. All the typical social media plugging type stuff. You know the drill. If you've heard any podcast before, you've probably heard this exact speech a million times. So, thanks for listening.